Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. This week on our show, we'll hear an encore presentation of our interview with painter Patrick Henry. We'll also revisit our stories on the button-making industry and the importance of the tomato canning industry in our farming heritage. And we'll finish up with a new interview between naturalist Dave Wilson and Jim White of the Delaware Nature Society. They'll be talking about Delmarva's beautiful and mysterious dragonflies. Patrick Henry is perhaps the preeminent Impressionist painter from Worcester County. Full disclosure, Pat and I are friends. We go way back, so I'm a little biased. He's not only one of the best-known artists in the area, but also a really nice guy. I recently met with him in his studio and asked him to tell me how some of his painting series from the recent past have taken him out of the genre most people know him for.
The backdrop for the paintings was downtown Ocean City around the inlet, with Tremper's Rides being in the forefront of the images, in particular the carousel, which is, I'm also a history buff, so that was a great backdrop. And it was so funny about the series, it was received positive and negative, because some people, the horses, which are the intentions, full of drama, some people couldn't take that. Some people couldn't take that I had moved away from scenics. And so, you know, as soon as somebody tried to box me in, I gravitate. So the next series that I did was Indifferent Lights, and it was this sort of crossover into scenes from New York, Chicago, really kind of biting the bullet, taking a what could have been perceived as a serious risk in going out of your market, quote unquote, and doing scenes that are totally different. But again, and again, the intention was experimenting with some colors, and now it's evolved to this series now. The title is Moments, subtitle In Color, Texture, Light, and Geometry, where in my painting life, my painting career, I've gone full circle. I feel like I've gone back to high school and painting for the sheer joy.
This work will be exhibited at the Ocean City Center for the Arts during the month of August 2015. Patrick says tackling new subject matter helps him to grow as an artist.
It was a very satisfying series for me because I went back to my artist child. I have, since the age of 14 or 15, had a serious passion for the process of oil painting. I have used acrylics, watercolors. Lately, I've been doing a series of pen and ink sketches, but oils is my love. And so for the past almost 50 years, it's been oil painting. I have always walked with this strong inner voice, and I'm very curious. I study everything. Travel, they had said, you know, really opens the minds of artists. And sure enough, it was no way I could come back here and look at those images and see a few that I want to try. I want to go to a realm other than somebody want me to paint this or that, and to, you know, just explore.
You're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and we're talking to Impressionist painter Patrick Henry. Pat plans to take a break from exhibitions while he works on a variety of subjects, including still life, nature, and people and images from his files. During my visit, he was working on a painting of a group of children at a playground. The painting was in its earliest stage with the composition and some of the values blocked in with russet burnt sienna.
This one here was from my photo inventory. My mother was center coordinator for Head Start for years and years, and it was a scene of the kids. I was describing it to a friend of mine, and it's 20 Head Start children, and when a child is born and, you know, they're, young and being nurtured, there's so much promise, so much promise. And because of the events we have seen, you can see how much the world starts to eat at that promise. Some children, by being nurtured, make it through. So I was thinking, these little children, you know, 3, 4, 5 years old, you know, at the height of promise, this image was taken like 30 some years ago. Where, I wonder, where are they now? I wonder. And each one of them have their own different body language. This one has a security blanket. And I wonder about this one little white boy, how in the sea of black faces, where does he stand with race relations now?
Patrick sees his work as a spiritual calling. Advances in technology have changed the type of opportunities for employment. Patrick feels that the call to creativity can provide a much-needed outlet for young people trying to find their way.
I know for myself, when I work on a pen and ink sketch, or when I paint, I go into a prayer-like state that I don't want to come out of. But I know, you know, you have responsibilities with the world, but it will give young people some good quality time instead of acting out the way some of them do. As much as 63 as I was at 13 or 14, just mesmerized by how you can take these globs of color and make something come alive. And that is where I feel I am in this stage of my life.
Get links to Patrick's website, henryfinearts.org, and his Facebook page at our website. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/arts. With all the oysters being harvested along Delmarva's shores, it's not surprising to learn that a number of businesses developed which could make use of the remnant shells. That's because until recent generations, people would never think of throwing anything away without using every single part of it they possibly could. Some shells were used as construction material in the form of tabby, a type of concrete made from burnt and crushed oyster shells. They've also been used here as landfill. With the success of the oyster harvesting business, it's sometimes said that Crisfield was literally built on top of oyster shells. And at one time, Delmarva oyster shells were found in fashions near and far as buttons. Mother of pearl, or nacre, the iridescent inner coating of mollusk shells has been used as decoration and to make small utensils throughout history. Because of its strength and attractive sheen, during the late 18th and early 19th century, mother-of-pearl buttons became commonly used for men and women's clothing and shoes. After 1890, pearl buttons represented half the total production of all buttons made. In the United States, button production tripled by 1914. It's interesting that the popularity of mother-of-pearl buttons rose along with the American seafood industry. Button making was one of those cottage industries that flourished here on Delmarva. There were a number of factories in towns across the peninsula. People could either work at those plants, or if they had their own equipment, they could work at home when they were off duty from their day jobs. They were paid by the pound. A skilled cutter could produce anywhere from 100 to 300 pounds a week. Blank button discs were stamped out of shells with a drill press. Chemical baths were used to treat and tint them. Some factories here completed the process drilling the holes. Others would simply turn out the discs and ship them to other factories off the shore to finish making them into buttons and sequins. You're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and we're talking about the Delmarva button industry. The last family-owned button factory in the country was the Martinek plant on Elliott Island in Dorchester County, Maryland. The Martineks moved here from New Jersey in the 1950s. Their equipment and related memorabilia was donated to the Vienna Heritage Museum after they closed in 1999. At the height of their success, Elvis Presley and the Barbie doll had costumes made with Martinek sequins. Milton, Delaware became a center for button making, particularly during the Great Depression, when the shipbuilding industry was on the decline. More and more people seemed to need buttons. They could not afford new clothes and would replace broken or missing buttons rather than discard a garment. At one time, as many as 8 button-making shops existed in Milton. At the same time, an untold number of individual families were cranking out button blanks at their homes. The most famous of the bigger Milton operations was the Lippincott factory and the Excelsior Button Works. Lippincott's was the largest, employing between 100 and 120 workers. The Milton buttons, however, were not made from oysters, but from abalone shells imported from the South Pacific. By the late 1950s, the American-made pearl button industry began to decline. This was in large part due to the influx of cheaper plastic buttons produced in Asia. And as fashions changed, buttons became larger and flashier. By the 60s, mother-of-pearl buttons could not compete with large, psychedelically colored buttons that were all the rage. So Delmarva button cutting shops eventually all closed up. If you live in Milton, when digging in your yard, you may even find a cache of glimmering mother-of-pearl shells left over from some home button-cutting operation. When I was a little girl, many of the white button-down shirts my family and I owned had mother-of-pearl buttons. They've actually never gone completely out of fashion, particularly for wedding gowns and men's formal attire. Now they are collected by aficionados of vintage clothing. People use them to make jewelry and all manner of decorative tchotchkes. I'm sure there are many seamstresses and crafters here on Delmarva today that make use of real mother-of-pearl buttons, but they don't come from here. That's kind of a shame because it's not like we have a shortage of oyster shells just yet. If you'd like to learn more about Delmarva's button industry, visit the Milton Historical Society and the Vienna Heritage Museum. Find links to their websites and upcoming heritage events on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/history. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. The third week in August seems to be the time of year that our weather pivots towards fall, and the tropics follow suit by erupting in foul weather. On August 21, 1888, waterspouts were seen over the Chesapeake Bay, and tornadoes erupted across Maryland and Delaware. And August 23, 1933, is the date of the hurricane that famously destroyed much of downtown Ocean City and created the inlet we have today at what was then South 2nd Street. Let's take a break now. When we come back, we'll hear about our tomato heritage, and naturalist Dave Wilson will have an interview about those beautiful and mysterious dragonflies. So stay tuned. The Delmarva Almanac is brought to you in part by the following towns where the arts are flourishing. In Maryland, visit Centerville, Denton, Ocean City, Princess Anne, and Stevensville. And in Delaware, visit Dover, Milford, and Rehoboth Beach. Visit our website for links to their galleries, eateries, and arts-related events. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/artstowns. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. This is Dana Kester McCabe. When you think of quintessential Delmarva crops, corn and soybeans often come to mind. Certainly strawberries, peaches, and even pumpkins are what we see along our roadsides throughout the growing season. But the mighty tomato has had as great an impact on the diet, culture, and economy of Delmarva as any other crop. It seems funny to refer to the tomato as a berry, but that is essentially what it is, a very big berry. The tomato vine is a member of the nightshade family. It is technically a fruit, but it is used as a vegetable. Believe it or not, the venerated U.S. Supreme Court has actually weighed in on that distinction. In the late 19th century, the state of New York had an import tax on vegetables, but not fruit. When they tried to impose taxes on tomatoes, importers responded by taking them to court. The case went all the way to the top, with the Supreme Court unanimously deciding that because of its common usage as a vegetable, it should be taxed as one. There are several varieties of tomatoes available year-round in our markets, but fresh, locally grown tomatoes found at your nearby roadside stand from June through September are simply the best. Though the big, deep red beefsteak tomato probably remains the champion, in recent years, heirloom tomato varieties have become very popular. They come in just about every color of the rainbow except blue. These are touted for their intensity of flavor and nutrition. Scientists are divided about whether heirloom seeds, saved and passed down from year to year and generation to generation, are as desirable as those that come from more currently hybridized plants. This is the heart of the debate about all genetically manufactured crops, which is essentially what all hybrid plants are in some form or fashion. For the average gardener, the question is answered by their own experience. Tomatoes that get the proper amount of sun and water and which are grown in really good soil taste the best no matter what variety they are. The attentive gardener can have as productive vines planting them in the ground as they do when planted in containers. Beginning gardeners often have their first success growing the versatile tomato. The tomato's history as a plant cultivated for human consumption has its beginnings in Peru, where archaeologists have found evidence of its use as far back as 500 BC. Over time, the tomato was grown and eaten throughout southern and central America. When Europeans invaded Mexico, tomato seeds were among the plunder which they brought back home with them. After some initial fears about tomatoes being poisonous, the tomato became a culinary sensation. Some called them love apples. There are too many dishes to name, but Spanish paella and Italian tomato sauces and their many variations became dietary staples, especially in the Mediterranean climate, where tomatoes grew voraciously. Tomato seeds came back to the Americas again with a colonist who grew tomatoes in their gardens. By the mid-1850s, canning plants dotted the peninsula for the commercial preservation and transport of seafood and a variety of fruits and vegetables. Things really took off when cheap tin cans became widely available from manufacturing plants in Baltimore. In the early 20th century, there were probably more than 100 canneries here with a large concentration in Wicomico County. Cambridge once promoted itself as the tomato canning capital of the world. In 1912, even Ocean City had a cannery with tomatoes being delivered by barge for processing. The owners of these canning operations made great fortunes and rose in the ranks of society and politics locally and beyond. In the beginning, the workers in those plants were poor whites and African American slave descendants. As immigration increased, Italians and Slavic workers drifted out of the big cities to find work and less crowded living conditions here on the Eastern Shore. At the height of Delmarva's canning industry, there were as many as 15,000 cannery workers. Some made as much as $5 a day, which for the time was a decent wage. This all began to decline in the 1950s, with competition from other warm-weather states who had longer growing seasons. Labor conflicts and advances in refrigerated shipping brought about a consolidation of canning. Delmarva's smaller local operations were squeezed out of business. Now most of the canned tomato products we use come from California, Italy, and beyond. Tomatoes are still a cash crop here on Delmarva, but not many farmers want to take them on. Though there are some mechanical solutions available, picking tomatoes for the most part still requires human hands because of their delicate nature. Immigrant laborers who do this work come mostly from Latin America. It's interesting that the cuisine they've brought with them really brings the tomato full circle. Variations on their traditional dishes like salsa are as commonplace in restaurants as pizza or ketchup on hamburgers and french fries. Tomatoes are in fact found in cuisines all around the world. One of the reasons that tomatoes are so widely loved is that for every fancy dish you can make with them, there is one that requires no particular skill at all. And really, there is nothing like that first fresh, ripe tomato of the summer. I've known some people who will eat them like an apple. No slicing or dicing, just a great big bite out of the middle, letting the juice run down their chin. My favorite summer tomato recipe is simply to take corn cut from the cob after it has been blanched and cooled and mix it with diced tomatoes and minced shallots. A splash of olive oil and ordinary vinegar with a little salt and pepper is the perfect summer salad. If you like things spicy, add your favorite minced pepper and a few sprigs of cilantro. The muddy tomato continues to prevail as an important part of our diet, so every summer it is celebrated in Vienna, Maryland at the Great Eastern Shore Tomato Festival. This lovely country fair is hosted by the Dorchester Historical Society, and it is actually today, August 20th, in Vienna, Maryland. So head over there. Or if you're in your car traveling to the beach on Route 50 right now, make a pit stop in Vienna and check it out. And for the rest of you, if you aren't growing your own juicy maters, pick some up at one of our fine local produce stands and farmers markets. Find out about other home and garden events on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/living. We're so glad that you've joined us for the Delmarva Almanac today. Now here is naturalist Dave Wilson with a conversation about dragonflies and their kin.
In the studio today, we have Jim White from the Delaware Nature Society and co-author with his wife Amy of The Amphibians and Reptiles of Delmarva. Jim is a native Delawarean and has worked for the Delaware Nature Society for 33 years, where he is currently serving as the Senior Fellow for Land and Biodiversity Management. He teaches herpetology at the University of Delaware. Jim just happens to have a remarkably extensive knowledge about some of our flying insect friends, namely damselflies and dragonflies, and today we're going to talk to him about this mysterious and often remarkably beautiful group of invertebrates. Jim, welcome.
Hi, Dave. Good to be here.
First off, can you tell us how you learned about dragonflies and damselflies, and how old are these species?
Yeah, sure. Well, I was lucky enough to meet a friend of mine, no relation, Hal White, who is a retired University of Delaware professor, about 15 years ago. And ever since, we've been going on field trips, and he's taught me a lot about damselflies and dragonflies. He also is the author of The Dragonflies and Damselflies of Delmarva, which was produced by the Delaware Nature Society. I was able to help him a little bit on that book with photography and actually on some of the field trips. Now, the difference between damselflies and dragonflies, that's a question often answered. They're both in the group called odonates, or in the class Odonata. These are, so they're very closely related. However, in the field, it's easy to tell them apart. Damselflies are, as their name implies, is a delicate insect. It flies very slowly. It tends to hold its wings above its back, which is kind of interesting. They also have eyes out on stalks. If you look very close at a damselfly, you'll see the eyes are way out on the side, almost like a, I don't know if you know, a blue crab, how they have them on a stalk. Dragonflies, on the other hand, tend to be robust, very strong flyers. They get a lot larger, at least here on Delmarva. And they hold their wings at, when they're perched, perpendicular to the body, very flat. I'm sure most people know that the difference, probably, if they've seen them in the field.
You know how old some of these species, or I guess the order really is? I remember as a kid looking at my dinosaur book and seeing these giant dragonflies. It seems like this is an old order of insects.
Oh, yeah. Actually, they predate the dinosaurs. Some of the ancestors of today's odonates were around 300 million years ago. So that predates dinosaurs almost by 100 million years. So they've been around for a long time. And I don't know if you remember, some of those early odonates were large. Some of them had wingspans up to a meter. I know when I was young, I was wishing they were still around.
What would an odonate with a wingspan of a meter eat is the question, I guess.
Well, they probably ate insects, mainly larger insects. Insects were larger back then, and dragonflies were larger for one particular reason. There was a group of animals that had not evolved yet, and that's the birds. So after the birds evolved, dragonflies tend to get smaller. They had to be very much quicker in flight, so they became smaller. And today, the largest dragonfly probably only has a wingspan of about 7 inches.
What are some of the most common species we have here on Delmarva?
Well, one of the most common, it's also one of our larger ones, is the green darner. This is a really beautiful insect. Has a really interesting life history because it's one of the few insect species that actually migrates. It migrates from the south up here to the north every year, and then its offspring migrate back. So it's very commonly observed by people. But there's many other species that you'll see around ponds that are very, very common.
What are some of the most sort of sought after and beautiful dragonflies and damselflies?
Well, there are several that us, the folks who really go out and look for them, are always searching for. One of them is the elfin skimmer. It's a dragonfly, but it's actually one of the smallest dragonflies in the world. It's really a gorgeous little species. There's several others that are just very, very beautiful. The Needham skimmer, which is very common, actually, especially down here along the coast. But it's one of those species that great to photograph, just beautiful.
You have a sense of how many species of dragonflies and damselflies there are on the peninsula?
Yeah, there's over 130 that have been actually observed. Now, some of them aren't here today. They've been extirpated probably. And some of those are probably migrants that just happen to blow in here on a storm.
What do most damselflies and dragonflies eat?
Well, as adults, they all eat flying insects. So they eat flies, they eat butterflies, they eat bees, some of them. They eat all different types of flying insects. Some of the smaller ones actually eat mosquitoes.
Can you talk about their life cycle a little bit? I know dragonflies and damselflies' life cycles are very interesting, beginning in water and I think listeners would love to hear about some of that.
Right. All the species here on Delmarva begin in the water. The females lay the eggs in the water or very close to the water. As the eggs hatch, they hatch into larvae, and these larvae are completely aquatic. And the larvae can actually live 2 or 3 years. And that's a little different than the adult. The adults only live for one season, one spring, summer, and fall. So there's basically a double life. The larvae in the water catching little aquatic insects and then transforming to the adult.
Do these species live in a variety of water types? Or in other words, do they need permanent ponds or temporary ponds or creeks and rivers, or is there a preference based on species?
Well, that's a very good question. It all depends on the species. Some species are generalist. They can live in just about any kind of still water, ponds. It doesn't even need to be that clean. They can be actually in water that's somewhat polluted. And then there's other species that are specialists of very clean, cool streams. So, yeah, there's a very large variety in what types of water they need.
A lot of frog species need fishless or relatively fishless ponds. Is this true also for dragonflies and damselflies?
There are some species that prefer ephemeral pools or fishless pools. But the vast majority of them seem to be able to deal with some sort of fish pressure. Yeah.
Are there certain birds that target dragonflies and damselflies?
Oh, yeah, all the flycatchers, the eastern phoebe, the eastern kingbird. Often, if you sit and watch an eastern kingbird, he'll snag a dragonfly.
What kind of threats do dragonflies and damselflies face on the peninsula?
Well, the biggest threat is habitat loss and water quality. Whether it be the stream that they're laying their eggs in, has become polluted, or even too much sun reaching that stream because the forest has been cut down around the stream. Very serious. So, as water quality degrades, the diversity of odonates goes down.
Where can people find out more about these species?
Well, Hal White's books is a great resource for Delmarva. He took his 50 years of studying these insects on Delmarva, and he took his experiences with each species, and he wrote vignettes about these species, about the life histories, just amazing amount of information in that book. I think that'd be the first book I'd recommend. And then there's several others if you go online. There's some books that have just been published about the eastern United States. So you'll find a lot of resources on the web.
We've been talking to Jim White today from the Delaware Nature Society. To learn more about dragonflies and other native wildlife of the peninsula, go to delnature.org or visit us online at delmarvaalmanac.com/nature.
Thanks, Dave. Well, that's all for this edition of the Delmarva Almanac. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and next week join us to learn more about our local culture and get connected to our natural wonders. We'd like to thank our community partners, the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio, and our underwriters for their help in bringing this program to you, our audience. If you'd like to become an underwriter for this program, visit delmarvaalmanac.com/support. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. Until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.